is about what we do this quarter. This course is a two-part course, so we just pick up where we left off, of course, and continue on. On that assignment schedule, you'll notice I follow the same procedure we did the last quarter. That is, there are reading assignments with a due date on Friday each week. There's a potential for a quiz on that material for each Friday. The books are Schultz, Finnegan, and one other book for Friday, April 15th. Edwin R. Teeley, A Chronology of the Hebrew Kings, honored in 1977. Teeley wrote a large volume called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings, in which he analyzed that chronological issue of the synchronization between the lengths of reigns of kings in the north and kings in the south. And that's long been recognized as a problem in biblical chronology, how you synchronize them. Because if you simply take the Book of Kings and start adding them up, pretty soon they're out of alignment. So-and-so reigned so many years in the north and so many years in the south. And then the next guy in the south began in a certain year of the rule of the king in the north, and he reigned so many more years. They're interrelated that way. And it's a problem if you just take the numbers as they are in the text and try to work out that synchronization. Now, Teeley spent probably most of his life working on that problem. He came up with certain ideas about the ways in which chronologies were kept in the ancient world, particularly in Israel. And some of those methodologies changed from time to time. Things like, when do you start a king's reign? Do you start it? In other words, suppose a king comes on the throne in December, using our calendar. When is the first year of his reign? Is it 1987 or is it 1988? Do you count the first full year, or do you count the section of the previous year as the first year of his reign? It's called accession year, non-accession year kind of system. That can make a difference, of course, of a year in each, depending on which way you count that. Other things like co-regencies, where one king would reign and then appoint his son to begin his reign, and they'd continue reigning together for a period of time. There'd be an overlap. And then the question is, when do you count the end of the reign of the first king? When he ended his rule totally, or when the co-regency began? And those are just two problems. Which calendar do you use in Israel for the beginning of the year? Use a religious calendar or the civil calendar? There were different calendars. There are a lot of factors like that. Well, he worked out by assuming certain things, principles that do resolve, for the most part, these problems of synchronization of chronologies. Not totally, but for the most part. That book is a very technical book. It's a very lengthy book. The one on your assignment sheet is a popularized summary of his findings, which is a short book in a relatively popular style. Unfortunately, it went out of print a couple years ago, which is a real shame, because it's a real service for a purpose of a course like this to understand the nature of that problem. There are, however, I think around at least a dozen copies of that in the library on a reserve shelf. So notice the statement there, multiple copies on reserve in the library, plan ahead. Don't leave that reading until Wednesday of the week of April 15th. You may come there and find you can't get a book. Try to plan ahead. There should be plenty of copies for everyone. But for the rest, the readings are in Schultz, where you will read Schultz and also read the corresponding books in the Old Testament, Joshua and Judges for March 11th. And then Judges and Samuel as well. That's chapter 6 and 7 of Schultz. So when you read Schultz, be sure to read the corresponding section of the Old Testament as well. Now, I also had intended this afternoon to explain that statement there under Friday, March 11th, map study. I'm going to have to do that tomorrow because I didn't bring those sheets with me, I just realized. What I want you to do also this week is a map study. This isn't anything elaborate. It's just that I will give you a list of cities, rivers, some mountains, major geographic locations in Palestine that you encounter as soon as you come into Joshua and Judges. I'd like you to map them out so you have an idea of where these places are. But I'll give you that list tomorrow. But that map then would be due on Friday this week. Also on that map would be the tribal boundaries. You get to the latter part of the book of Joshua, the land is divided, and borders are assigned to each of the tribes. So I want you to know, where the tribe of Judah is, Ephraim, Manasseh, so forth. There will be a map question on the midterm exam. Midterm's April 8th. So I won't quiz you Friday on the map. There is a possibility of quiz on reading. I'm not saying I will, but it's a possibility. But I will have a map question on the midterm exam. What I'll do is put a map on the screen with letters and numbers. And I'll give you names that you have to match then with some letters and numbers. And that will particularly apply to tribal areas. I'd like you to know where the tribes are. Okay? One other thing. Bottom of the page. Extra credit. You may receive extra credit for the course by reading one or more of the following books. Your final grade will be raised by the amount indicated after the title. No one may receive more than 4/10 of a grade point extra credit. I have 4 books listed there, 3 of them by Walter Kaiser. The first was J. Barton Payne, Theology of the Older Testament, 4/10 of a grade point. That's a rather large book. It's an Old Testament theology. Any of Kaiser's books, 2/10 of a grade point. So you could either read Payne for 4, you could read 2 of Kaiser for 4, you could read 1 of Kaiser for 2/10 of a grade point extra credit. Now that extra credit is on your final grade. In other words, whatever your average comes out at the end of the quarter, if you have done that, and you notice in order to receive this credit, you must give me a written statement that you've read the entire book carefully. That's what I ask. There's a deadline on that, though, which is prior to the end of the semester. It's April 29th. Notice that. In other words, I don't want you spending reading the last week or two of the semester trying to catch up on reading. You really ought to be putting your time on your other courses as well as this course. But if you do that by April 29th, I'll give you that credit. You give me the statement, you read the entire book, and you read it carefully. Just don't turn the pages, and skim it. You read it.
So if I understand correctly, the person had a 9.
Yes. Yes. Well, see, if you're, I'm just glancing down a column here. I'm glancing down a column. Yeah, it's a 4-point system. In other words, yeah.
That's what I wanted to find out.
If you had a, for example, if you had a 2-point, here's somebody with a 2.64 average at the end of the quarter. If they did 4/10 of a grade point, they would have a 3.04, which would raise them from a C plus to a B. Or maybe it's a B minus to a B. So 2.64. It would be a B minus to a B. It would raise it. Now, it depends on where you fall on the scale, of course, but generally it would make a difference of a plus or a minus. Any other questions? Yes. No, you read all of Joshua and Judges. I don't know how that Judges got in there twice. I don't have Schultz with me, or I could check what chapter 7 is. I assume that... Yes, read it once. Yes. I'm not sure whether 6 is Joshua and Judges or whether 6 is Joshua and 7 is Judges and Samuel. I'm not sure. I don't know why that's there twice. Just an error. Okay. Anything else? Okay. If you find your class lecture outline that we used last quarter, see if I can find mine here. We were discussing, when the quarter came to an end, the life of Joseph, which is G on page 4, question. You don't have one. I thought I'd hand them out, but I missed you, I guess. Yeah. I don't seem to have another copy. We were discussing the life of Joseph, which is G on page 4, and we'd come down to 3 under G, the significance of these events in the context of redemptive history. And I had mentioned one thing under that heading, and that was that in this section of Genesis, Genesis 37 till the end, Joseph temporarily becomes prominent, although Judah is the line of the promised seed. And that's what we had discussed at the end of the last week there before our break. So I want to pick up at that point. And this would be B then under 3. We're discussing the significance of these events in the context of redemptive history. B, the children of Israel are united and brought to Egypt, where in the isolation of Goshen they become a nation. The children of Israel are united and brought to Egypt, where in the isolation of Goshen they become a nation. Through Joseph, the house of Jacob is restored. And unity is restored to that house. There are a couple statements there in Exodus, in the latter part of Genesis. When Joseph has revealed himself to his brothers, and they are aware that here this man, this one that they had sold into Egypt is now powerful, he's a ruler, and could certainly take revenge. He doesn't do that. If you look at Genesis 45, verse 4, just after he has revealed who he is, Joseph says, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will not be plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God." In other words, that attitude of Joseph is really remarkable from a human standpoint. He seeks no revenge. But in taking that attitude, he restores the unity to the house of Jacob. Now, of course, that statement was made right at the time that he revealed himself to his brothers. Jacob hadn't even come down into Egypt yet. And of course, later the brothers go home, and Jacob comes down, and the entire family is in Egypt, and Jacob dies in Egypt. And the brothers, too, were still not too sure. What is Joseph going to do to us? Is he just going to wait until Jacob is dead, and then get his revenge? So you find in chapter 50, after Jacob has died, verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him. So they sent word to Joseph saying, your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you were to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me. But God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and for your children. So with that attitude, the family is united. It seems that the brothers repent of their offense against Joseph. Joseph forgives them. The envy in the relationship, or the envy seems to be overcome in their relationship to Benjamin, the other son of Rachel. Remember, Joseph was the favorite son of his father, and the brothers resented that. But in this situation, the brothers are very much concerned for Benjamin, who was the other son of Rachel. Remember, you get that Leah-Rachel tension within the family of Jacob that we talked about earlier. And that continued on, it seems, at this point. But with this situation, they're very protective of Benjamin. They're very much disturbed when Benjamin had to be brought down into Egypt. You remember that Judah offered himself for Benjamin as a surety. He seems to speak for all of them in that. But in 43:3, after that cup, was that? No, that's prior to that. In 43:3, that's when they had come back from their first journey down there and been told, don't come back again and seek more food, unless you bring Benjamin with you. And Jacob didn't want to let Benjamin go because he'd already lost Joseph. He didn't want to lose Benjamin. So you read in 43:3, Judah said to him, the man warned us solemnly, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. If you send your brother along, we will go down and buy food for you. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. Because the man said to us, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. And then down in verse 8 and 9, Judah said to Israel, his father, send the boy along with me, and we will go at once, so that we and you and our children may live and not die. I myself will guarantee his safety. You can hold me personally responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him here before you, I will bear the blame before you all my life. So Judah offers himself in that way as a surety for Benjamin. And the unity in the house is restored. So everybody contributes something, you might say. Joseph contributes something. Judah contributes something. Jacob contributes something. So that the ancestors of the nation are preserved and brought to Egypt, where they grow to be a nation. Now, the climax of this whole section is in 44:18-33. I think I'll read that. This is after they have taken Benjamin and gone back to Egypt, gotten their food, and left. And Joseph had that silver cup placed in Benjamin's sack. And then they're pursued and it's discovered that that silver cup was in Benjamin's sack. And he is then taken back as a prisoner. And in verse 18 of 44, you read, Judah went up to him and said, please, my lord, let your servant speak a word to my lord. Do not be angry with your servant, though you are equal to Pharaoh himself. My lord asked his servants, do you have a father or a brother? We answered, we have an aged father, and there is a young son born to him in his old age. His brother is dead, and he is the only one of his mother's sons left, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me, so I can see him for myself. And we said to my lord, the boy cannot leave his father. If he leaves him, his father will die. But you told your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what my Lord had said. Then our father said, go back and buy a little more food. But we said, we cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother is with us will we go. We cannot see the man's face unless our younger brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One of them went away from me. And I said, he has surely been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and harm comes to him, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in misery. So now if the boy is not with us, when I go back to your servant my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy. And let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come on my father. That's a very dramatic picture, where Judah presents himself and pleads for himself to be put in place of Benjamin so that Benjamin is not kept there. In this book, I think I mentioned early on in the course, The Art of Biblical Narrative by Robert Alter. Alter is one of the advocates of this new so-called literary approach to analysis of Old Testament narrative. Some aspects of this book are good, some are bad. But in connection with this passage, he makes some interesting remarks that I thought I would read to you. He says, in light of all that we have seen about the story of Joseph, this is on page 174 of Alter's The Art of Biblical Narrative. In light of all that we have seen about the story of Joseph and his brothers, it should be clear that this remarkable speech is a point-for-point undoing, morally and psychologically, of the brothers' earlier violation of fraternal and filial bonds. A basic biblical perception about both human relations and relations between God and man is that love is unpredictable, arbitrary, at times perhaps seemingly unjust, and Judah now comes to an acceptance of that fact with all its consequences. His father, he states clearly to Joseph, has singled out Benjamin for a special love, as he singled out Rachel's other son before. It is a painful reality of favoritism with which Judah, in contrast to the earlier jealousy over Joseph, is here reconciled, out of filial duty and more out of filial love. His entire speech is motivated by the deepest empathy for his father, by a real understanding of what it means for the old man's very life to be bound up with that of the lad. He can even bring himself to quote, sympathetically, verse 27, Jacob's typically extravagant statement that his wife bore him two sons. Now see, that's, you know, my wife bore me two sons, Jacob says. As though Leah were not also his wife, and the other ten were not also his sons. 22 years earlier, Judah engineered the selling of Joseph into slavery. Now he's prepared to offer himself as a slave so that the other son of Rachel can be set free. 22 years earlier, he stood with his brothers and silently watched when the bloody tunic they had brought to Jacob sent their father into a fit of anguish. Now he's willing to do anything in order not to have to see his father suffer that way again. So you get a reversal, you see, of the earlier situation. So I think what we see then, as far as a redemptive historical perspective in the movement of these narratives, is that the children of Israel are united, brought to Egypt, where in the isolation, really don't know how long, as far as I can tell, we don't know how long Joseph was in Egypt before Jacob came down into Egypt. We know that there were 7 years of famines, seven lean years, seven fat years. You could say, you know, when the famine was up, that would have been 14 years. How long was he in prison? was in prison for a couple of years. How long was it there before he went to prison? You don't know exactly. Oh. How do you get that? 17. Does it say he was 17 when he went down? Okay. Seems to me approximately 20 years is a reasonable estimate before Jacob comes down. All right, number four is, when did Joseph enter Egypt? When did Joseph enter Egypt? This, of course, is related to the question of that we'll look at shortly, and that is the date of the Exodus. But at this point, it's a question in its own right. When you read in chapter 39, verse 1, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The problem is, it doesn't tell us the name of the Pharaoh. See, in 39:1, it just says, Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials. And that's characteristic not only in Genesis here, but also in the early chapters of Exodus, that when the Egyptian ruler is spoken of, he's just referred to by that title, Pharaoh, and no name is given. And that's part of the reason why it's very difficult to tie this in directly with Egyptian history, which would then give us a date, a firm date. Who was the Pharaoh? Well, we really don't know. If we work with the biblical chronological data, it gets somewhat complex, but we really have already gone over most of this in connection with our discussion of the dating of the patriarchs. Remember that we said that the dating of the patriarchs rests on two variables. And the two variables are the date of the Exodus and Exodus 12:40. Whether you take the Masoretic text or the Septuagint reading, which means, was Israel 430 years in Egypt or 215 years in Egypt? But a summary of that then, of the patriarchal material, is depending on A or 1, the date of the Exodus, 1446 or 1290. And two, whether one follows the Masoretic text of the Septuagint in Exodus 12:40, did Abraham enter Canaan 430 years before the Exodus or 645 years before the Exodus? The possibilities are, for the patriarchal period, early date for the Exodus in the Masoretic text, 2091. Or the birth of Abraham. Or with the late date for the Exodus in the Masoretic text, 1935, for the birth of Abraham. Now, if you take those figures, 2091 and 1935, which are, I think, the most likely two figures, that's assuming the Masoretic text in Exodus 12:40, and that's assuming either an early or a late date for the Exodus. So if you take that 2091 figure or the 1290 figure, you work this way then. When did Joseph enter Egypt? If you take the 2091 date, which would mean 2166 is the date of Abraham's birth. The reason for that is Abraham was 75 years old when he came down into Canaan. 2166 being the date of Abraham's birth, then you work this way. You take 160 years that Jacob was born after Abraham. And I won't, we looked at that previously. You have to trace the ages of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which you can do. You find that Jacob was born 160 years after Abraham. Jacob was 130 when he came down into Egypt. You find that in Genesis 47:9, where you read, Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult, and so forth. If you assume that Joseph had been in Egypt for approximately 20 years already, so you subtract 20 from that, you get a figure of 270, and you subtract the 270 from 2166. That would give you 1896 for the year of the arrival of Joseph in Egypt. So that could be plus or minus a few years based on this unknown of how long Joseph has been in Egypt. But approximately 1896, based on, you see, an early date view of the Exodus, because this figure is assuming an early date, your starting point is assuming an early date for the Exodus. Now, if you assume the late date for the Exodus and work with that 1935 figure, then you do the same thing. And you take the 160, the 130, the minus the 20, that's 270. You subtract the 270 from 2010, you get 1740 as the year of the arrival of Joseph. So those are really your two possibilities, working with the biblical data of length of life of the patriarchs. Remember, you see, really, to get to that point, you have to work two ways. In other words, really start the first thing. 6 months. Work back. And then you can establish the date of the birth of Abraham, and then you follow down through Isaac and Jacob. And you work to sit back this way to the 6 point year. So you have to get it for an hour.
All right. What are the implications of those two dates, 1896 versus 1740? If you take the early date, the 1896 date, that would place Joseph in the period of the 12th dynasty of Egypt, which was a native Egyptian dynasty. The 12th dynasty reigned from 1991 to 1786. If, however, you take the later date, 1740, that would place Joseph in the time of the Hyksos. You see, that's why some of the interest in this question. The Hyksos were those foreign rulers who came in and gained control of Egypt for a period of time. Generally dated 1750, about 1570. Although the precise dates of the Hyksos period are somewhat obscure because of the lack of firm historical data. But generally they're placed about 1750-1570. So you see that 1740 would be shortly after the Hyksos came to power. If this date is correct, now the idea that Jacob and his family, Joseph, came down to Egypt during the time of the Hyksos is a very old idea. Josephus says that a Hyksos dynasty was ruling Egypt when Joseph became prime minister in Pharaoh's court. Now, that's found in Josephus. Not that that is a very good authority, because in the same context where Josephus says that, he then goes on to identify the Hyksos with the Israelites. And he feels that the expulsion of the Hyksos is to be identified with the Exodus. And that certainly is not accurate historically. But what Josephus is interested in doing when he speaks about Joseph coming into Egypt during the time of Hyksos is to establish the antiquity of the Jews. And he uses that kind of a historical argument. Now, what we do know about the Hyksos is not a whole lot, but they were Asiatic invaders who came to power at about 1750, although the exact time is not clear, but approximately 1750, ruled for a couple centuries. The Egyptian historian Manetho, you read about him in Finnegan, Manetho was a historian from about 250 B.C., he explains the meaning of the name Hyksos as shepherd kings. You've probably heard that before. The Hyksos were shepherd kings. Manetho felt that the very word Hyksos meant shepherd king. The etymology of that term Hyksos, however, is much debated. Most scholars today are not ready to accept Manetho's explanation of the meaning of the term as shepherd king. Most scholars today think the term means foreign rulers, rulers of foreign lands. But in any case, you had these Hyksos who ruled in Egypt at that particular period of time. And it's always been a question of some interest whether Joseph came into power during the early days of Hyksos rule or whether he came to power prior to that under native Egyptian dynasty. And depending on which one of these. If you can see, if you take the early date for the Exodus, you're going to say he came in prior to the Exodus. Yeah.
How much is known about the land creation? It's part of the lower
Upper Egypt.
Yeah.
It's confusing. Upper Egypt is the delta area. Even though on a map, you know, you think Upper Egypt on a map, excuse me, Lower Egypt is the delta area. Upper Egypt is the upper region of the Nile, which is on the map, is down below. So it's reverse.
It doesn't have a lot of well preserved
No.
But is there anything known about whether there were Hyksos?
No, but it is known that the Hyksos had their center, their capital, in the Delta region. So again, that fits. That's one of the lines of argument used to associate Joseph with the Hyksos, but the Hyksos centered there.
It's like the frontier.
That's right. That's right. But, yeah. The great Egyptian rulers had their capitals further to the south. Well, whether or not he came in under the Hyksos or prior to the Hyksos, of course, does have some bearing on the events of the Exodus and the oppressions that were connected with the Exodus. It's a debated issue. The kinds of arguments that are used to support one position or the other, apart from the chronological material, are not decisive. I don't think you can really settle it. Let me just give you some idea of the kinds of arguments. Those who favor Joseph's rise to power during Hyksos rule, that would be the late date. Make some of the following arguments. In Genesis 47:17, you have a reference to horses. You read there, they brought their livestock to Joseph, and he gave them food in exchange for their horses, their sheep, their goats, their cattle, and their donkeys. Now, it's generally believed that the Hyksos were the first ones to import horses into Egypt. But there weren't horses in Egypt prior to the Hyksos. So the argument is, horses are mentioned here, this must be during the time of the Hyksos. Another argument is, Exodus 1:8 says, this argument cuts both ways, we'll see later. But Exodus 1:8 says, then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us, and so forth. The new king who knew not Joseph. It's said that that statement is best explained as a native Egyptian ruler that came to power after the expulsion of the Hyksos. The new king who knew not Joseph was a native Egyptian ruler. Came to power after the expulsion of the Hyksos. And in connection with that, it's said that this may explain the silence of Egyptian sources about Joseph and his work. He rose to such prominence in Egypt. There's no trace of that in any Egyptian records. And then the assumption is he rose to power under the Hyksos. When the native Egyptians came back, they just wiped out the history of that Hyksos period. And we know almost nothing about the Hyksos period because the Egyptians destroyed all traces of it. Third line of argument is what I just mentioned a minute ago. The Pharaoh in the time of Joseph seems to have had his residence in the Nile Delta area near the land of Goshen. And that's where Joseph was settled with his family, his father and his brothers. The Hyksos had their capital city and exercised their rule from the Delta area. So that that's a line of argument as well. Fourthly, it's said that it is more likely that under Hyksos rule, it would be possible for a Semite like Joseph to achieve the high position which he did. In other words, he was a foreigner, he wasn't an Egyptian. It would be more likely for someone like Joseph to rise to that prominent position when there was foreign rule in Egypt than it would when there was native Egyptian rule. And then in Genesis 39:1, where you read, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. It says, Potiphar, an Egyptian. And the point is made that that qualification or designation for Potiphar being an Egyptian is understandable only in the period of the Hyksos, when the Pharaoh himself was not of Egyptian origin. In other words, why would you add an Egyptian? It seems like that's an exception. What else would he be? He's in Egypt. You'd expect him to just say Potiphar. But if it's in the Hyksos period, here's something unique, you see. Here, this Potiphar is really an Egyptian. He's not a foreigner. Certainly not a conclusive argument by any means. So none of those arguments, even though they're plausible, they don't really, they're not conclusive. They don't force you to the conclusion that he had to come in during the time of Hyksos. I see my time's up. But look at some of the arguments the other way for coming in prior to Hyksos time, beginning the next hour.